This evening we're continuing with our thoughts about what it means to live as people of God in the mission of God. Esther, could you put up that first slide, please? And we've got this title, People Who Live and Work in the Public Square. Just trying to convey the idea that our faith is not just a personal, just a private thing, but something that affects how we engage with the society in which we live. If you were here last week, you may remember that we talked about the idea of being sent into the world to proclaim the gospel, the good news about Jesus, that it was a responsibility that all of us have, but some of us have a specific calling to be part of God's mission. And we had the privilege of having Brian and Lydia with us that morning to share something of what it meant to be missionaries in Thailand and Burma. And we recognised that there is that responsibility that we have to be sent, and sometimes to send people into the world to be part of what God is doing. This evening we're thinking a bit more generally about work, about our lives, our public engagement in the world. And I want to suggest there are some different ways we can look at it. Some of us may view it as a distraction. It's something I need to do. Those of us who are in work, something we need to do. Those of us who are retired, there are many, many things that occupy our time. And sometimes we can think, well, actually, if I weren't doing this, I could be doing more for God. Some of us may see it as an opportunity to witness and to say, well, I'm in this context with these people. It's an opportunity to talk about Jesus. And we've looked at that. We've explored that in the context of what we were thinking about with whole life discipleship. Some of us may see it as something that's actually important in its own right as the people of God. Remembering that God invented the idea of work as he created everything. And he gave man and woman the responsibility to care for this world and to develop it and to grow and to prosper and to subdue it. And he's given us responsibilities. And so there is a call on us to work, to engage, to be part of the world in which we live. Or some of us may treat it as most people do, those without a faith. It's something that occupies a lot of our time with very little thought about God and his world. How do we think about the lives that we live outside of these four and a few walls? The story we read from Daniel gives us, I would suggest, an interesting perspective on this question. We came across three friends, because the particular passage that we read is a story about those three men. They had been taken captive from their own country, from Jerusalem, and they had been forcibly introduced to a foreign court in Babylon, the center of the Babylonian Empire, where they served strange gods and they behaved in ways that were unfamiliar to these three men. But even in that alien context, they were prepared to engage and to work for the good of that society. Maybe they had little choice, but the indications we have suggest that they fully committed themselves to working in it and blessing the nation to which they'd been taken against their will and where they now lived. And we know, if you know the story, there was a fourth person who went with them, the person whose name goes with the book, Daniel, but he doesn't figure in this particular story. Whichever way you look at it, these three men have been taken out of their comfort zones. They've been among the elite in Jerusalem, royalty. They were living a life of luxury and privilege and had been brought into a new capital city as prisoners. A city with people who lived in a totally different way. They were living in a place where people worshipped and served different gods, and where the people would have assumed that their god was inferior to the gods of Babylon because they had won. these three men had been defeated. And in the context of that day, that would have said something about the relative merits of the gods they worshipped. At best, their god would have been seen to be irrelevant, but probably the basis of cruel jibes and jokes. They'd been given, if we look in chapter 1, we see they've been given new names. And names are so much part of our identity. And this would have been intended to make them fit into their new culture, to become part of the royal court, names that were familiar with everybody else who was there. Maybe it was intended kindly, so they didn't stick out. Maybe intended as a demonstration of the powerlessness of their situation. They couldn't even keep their own names. They were trained to work as civil servants, so not even able to choose their own occupation. Some of these things don't apply to us. I've never been forcibly removed from my country and I had to settle somewhere else. But there are some things I would suggest that resonate so closely with our context and the world in which we live and work and engage socially. It's a world that does not recognize the kingdom of God. It does not recognize the ways of God. It follows its own path. God's name is thought little of, but God is often blamed when things go wrong. We're pressured from many directions to fit in, to adapt to our culture, to be part of it, to not rock the boat, but go along with everyone else. Sometimes we find ourselves in situations we don't want to be in, situations we didn't choose, but ones we just need to cope with. So the example of these three men is interesting. God gave them knowledge and understanding, and at the end of their training, they were recognized, along with Daniel, as being significantly more capable than anyone else, all the wise men, all the clever people in Babylon. And a little later, they were promoted to manage the province of Babylon, the capital city to which they'd been taken as captives. They were doing well in that structure. God was with them, and it seems they were committed to the work they'd been given, even though it was living in and serving a foreign enemy power. But it doesn't change from what we see today. Their promotion and position caused other people in the civil service, in the government, to be jealous. And they look for opportunities to bring these three men down. There are ongoing rumours that some people in the Tory party want another leader. And there are discussions. And it's an interesting spectator sport. But these things have always been with us. And this is what was going on here. There were people in Babylon who thought that they were some of the key players, and suddenly there were these three who've been promoted above them, and they are not happy. And they were looking for an opportunity to do something about it. And their refusal to worship this ridiculously large image of the king was their chance. This image was about 90 feet high. Solid, made of gold. It's a bit excessive. And they said, no. We are not going to bow down and worship this. And so this was their chance. So they bring this to the king's notice. They point out that these men refused to do what the king had commanded, which was not a good place to be. Specifically, they say this, and Anne read this earlier, there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up. You put them there, O king. It was your choice, but they're not doing what you are telling them to do. What are you going to do about it? But I think this is hugely significant. These men had gone along with many of the things that had been expected of them. They'd taken foreign names. They'd been educated in the ways of Babylon. They'd taken responsible positions in the administration of the empire. They'd served the king well. You could have looked at them and would have thought, well, they're the same as everybody else. They look the same. They dress the same. Their language is the same. They just fit in. You would have thought that they had totally assimilated to the culture, become part of it. But here, we see that there was a line they would not cross, a point beyond which they would not go. We saw hints of this earlier in the story, if we'd read the previous chapters, where they asked not to have to eat food that was probably ritually unclean. It would have been an offence to what they believed. But that was years ago, when they just arrived. And it would have been reasonable to expect that those types of scruples had long been left behind. But when interrogated by the king, they were quite clear. This was not just a lapse. They hadn't just forgotten to worship this image. And if you give us a second chance, we will take it, O king. This was a point of principle, a matter of deep, unshakable faith. It was all about their allegiance to their God, the God of their fathers, the God they continued to believe in, even though they lived in a foreign land. To have gone along with worshipping the king would have violated the first two commandments this God had given to their ancestors. We'll be looking at the Ten Commandments in a few weeks, up over July, end of July and August. But these first two commandments call God's people to not have any other gods but their God, and not to make any images. God said to his people, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the parents of the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. You shall not make an image. You shall not bow down to them. You shall not worship them." However these men appeared on the surface, however much they had become part of the culture, at their core was a totally unwavering commitment to God. And God was going to come first, even if it cost them their lives. They were prepared to live in the culture that they found themselves in. They worked hard in that society. They contributed significantly to the community. But there were limits to what they were prepared to do. And so the king was not pleased. He had them thrown into a massive fire. They came unscathed out of that. And afterwards, their commitment to God was recognized by the king. Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. We are called to contribute to the best of our ability in the situations we find ourselves, not as an imposition, not even so that we can witness to God, but because it is something that's expected of us as human beings, something that God established for his people to do. Work is good. Significant relationships with other people are good. Working to make the world a better place is something we should all be doing. But we always need to be on our guard about going over the line, about engaging with something, agreeing to something that is against what we believe God wants, what God commands. And we need to be prepared to say, no, whatever it may cost, if saying yes would let down the God we serve. And in doing so, we can demonstrate to others how important our God is to us and how we're committed to serving him first. In my second job, the job I had when Joe and I got married, we were living up in Oldham. I was responsible for the computer systems that managed a semiconductor factory. And it was a fun job. It had its moments. But there were some things that in my position, I knew about other people who used these systems, who were helping maintain the systems. And it was recognized that I had a duty of confidentiality to not divulge the information that I knew. There was a situation where there were questions and concerns about something that was going on, and one of the managers in the company came to me and said, you know, we need to know a bit about what's going on. And I went home to think about that, and I was not happy with what I was being asked to divulge, what I potentially was going to be asked to divulge about somebody, because I had that information in confidence, and it was something that I felt was wrong to share. But I was aware that if I refused, I could potentially lose my job. I discussed it with Joe, and we thought, what's the right thing to do? And the conclusion we came to is that if I was pushed to provide this information, I would say no, even if it meant losing my job. Just married, either had or just expecting our first son, a difficult situation. But sometimes we are called to be prepared to actually say no, even when saying yes would be the easy thing. As it happens, they didn't ask me, so that was easy. But going through that process was important. Let's not resent the things we are called to do, the situations we are called to be in. Let's do the best we can as though we are living and working for God. And by that example, we will show what it means to live as people of God. And these three men demonstrated that in an amazing way as they stood up to the king, the one who ruled the empire, the one who effectively ruled the world at that time. And they said, no, we don't care what you do to us. We will serve our God. And that's an amazing position to be able to be in. The passage we read from Colossians provides another interesting insight on this. It's an amazing passage. It speaks about the uniqueness of Jesus, the one who's supreme over all creation. It depicts him as the one who holds everything together, the one who's the head of the church, the one in whom we see fully and completely what God is like. At the start of the book of Hebrews, it talks about how God in the past has spoken to us and shown us who he is like through lots of different ways. But now he's revealed himself to us in his Son. And it's in Jesus we see what God is like. But this passage, as I mentioned, also speaks about the scope of what Christ has done and what God was going to do through him. Through him, to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. God, through Christ, through his sacrifice on the cross, was going to reconcile everything, to restore everything to relationship with him, to fix every single thing that has been broken or tarnished or damaged. What Jesus achieved on the cross was not just personal and individual. He died for me, and so I can be forgiven and restored to God. It was that, and that is wonderful, and the grounds by which we come into God's presence. But it was more than that. What Jesus achieved on the cross wasn't just about building his church, the community of people who believe in him and over which he is supreme, the head. It was that, and it's an incredible privilege to be part of that. But it's more than that. What Jesus achieved on the cross was the basis by which every single thing in the entire universe, every single event in history, will be put into its proper place before God. God is engaged in a project to repair the damage that has been done by sin, And this project is based on the sacrificial work of Jesus. Some people and things will willingly and gladly accept what Jesus has done. Some, such as the spiritual forces that oppose God, will need to be brought into submission. But in Christ, God will reconcile all things. And that's an amazing thing to think about. It's something I don't fully understand. I haven't quite got my head around it. But I find it wonderfully exciting as I try and make out some of its implications. That through the work of Christ on the cross, God has brought his entire rebellious creation back under the rule of his sovereign power. It's not fully there yet. We wait for the return of Christ for it to be complete. But this is what has happened because of what Jesus has done. And one of the implications of this is that the things I do, the mundane activities I'm involved in, the exciting things that I'm privileged to be part of, will be taken with all their imperfections and mistakes and presented as perfect to God as Jesus takes and reconciles them. What an amazing encouragement to work, to do, to commit to the things that we do as an offering to Christ, which one day he will make perfect. In a vision in Revelation, we get a glimpse of what will happen at the end of time as we know it. The time when Jesus will return, the time when God will come and live among his people. Revelation speaks about this being like a city where God dwells with his people. And we come across an interesting concept in Revelation chapter 21. The nations will walk by its light, the light of the city, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. It goes on, the glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Christopher Wright, who writes about this, says this, the splendor, glory, and honor of kings and nations is the combined product of generations of human beings whose lives and efforts will have generated the vast store of human culture and civilization. In other words, what will be brought into that great city of God in the new creation will be the vast accumulated work of human output through the ages. All this will be purged, cleansed, redeemed, and laid at the feet of Christ, which he will reconcile to enhance the lives we will live in God's presence. What an amazing prospect. What an encouragement to engage and to work and to do for the glory of God in the situations we find ourselves in, knowing that eventually Jesus will take the little things that we have to offer, the weak things that we have to offer, the broken things that we'll have to offer, and transform them into something that is great and glorious and good. What does that mean for us? I would suggest a few things. The example of the three men in Daniel encourages us to be fully engaged in the society in which we live, to work for the good of those communities. And for each of us, that will be different. In the places we spend our daily lives, what does it mean to be fully engaged? But their example also encourages us to be ready and willing to take a stand for God when things go further than they should be, and to be willing to do so whatever the individual costs. People through the ages have lost their lives as a result of their refusal to compromise their belief in God. Jesus speaks about those who wanting to follow him should take up their cross daily and follow him. What are we prepared to lose? What are we prepared to give up to say no to things that would go against what God is calling us to be and to do? The words of Paul in Colossians remind us that God is working to restore everything, however bad things may seem, and that he will do that in the person and work of Jesus Christ. And this should encourage us to be fully committed to the things we're involved in with total confidence that they will be perfected by Christ? Are we prepared to look at our lives in this way? Are we prepared to honour God in this way?